Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Happy Monday. When journalist and fatherhood columnist Josh Lev's child was born, his employer denied him fair parental leave. Many would have said, well, you know what, that's just the way business operates. But Josh fought back and corporate America responded. In the process, Josh Lev's became a leading advocate for modern families, and we'll hear from him in the second half of today's show. First, I'm very pleased to welcome back an author who's known for his exquisite storytelling and historical research. Blending fact with fiction, James McManus joins us for the fourth time today, this time with his latest novel, Midnight in Berlin. The Times Book Review says, it's almost impossible to tell a dull story about Berlin in the late 1930s, and this one is as pacey as any modern thriller, but with a touch of Edwardian adventure yarn. And James is the managing director of the Times Literary Supplement. His other novels include The Language of the Sea, Black Venus, and Sleeping Peace Tonight. In 2000 film, his film script about the life of British journalist George Hogg, based on his novel Ocean Devil, became a major motion picture. And James, I'd like to welcome James McManus. Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for having me back on your show.
Well, I have to tell you, James, I always get a little jolt when guests come back for the third or the fourth time with their third or their fourth or their fifth or their sixth book, and it makes me stop and think, okay, what have I done since we last talked? So you're really pumping out these books. You're being really prolific.
Thank you. I'm not sure about pumping out. I think Catholic crafting might be the expression.
There you go. Okay. All right. So I read on your website, we haven't talked about this before, so I thought we'd talk a little about this before we get right into the book, Midnight in Berlin. But you've been a newspaper man for 50 years. Does that feel like it's gone by in the blink of an eye?
It's certainly a very fast-moving profession. And it is true that for almost 50 years, a little less actually, I have been a journalist. Although in the last sort of 10 years, I have moved, as people of my generation tend to do, into more executive roles. But I think the point about journalism, it thrust me into great events, the troubles in Northern Ireland, the whole Rhodesian war and the wars in Africa, and then the Middle East. So yes, those years flashed past.
Yeah, and I think that exposure probably gives you a good eye when you're writing these stories, because you know, a couple of your latest books at least have been about war situations.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think one meets such an extraordinary gallery of people when one's on the road as a foreign correspondent that really helps when you come to craft characters for your stories. But the fact that I was a foreign correspondent isn't why I was drawn to World War II. That's sort of another story. And we'll come to that perhaps a bit later.
Okay. So as a foreign correspondent all those years, is there a story that really sticks with you or changed? I'm sure many of those stories changed your perspective on certain situations, but is the one that you feel really changed you as a man and as a journalist?
I don't think there's any one particular story that changed the way I looked at the world. I certainly felt after 4 years in the Middle East a great deal more worried about the way the world was going, and perhaps a bit more depressed about the future that I was going to leave my children in this world. But there was no one kind of epiphany which suddenly changed everything for me, no.
Right. And in your books, you are known to bring journalists in there. So is that a nod to fellow journalists?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, I work with journalists for most of my life. I admire them hugely. As a profession, they don't get a very good press. They're not rated very highly by the public, sometimes for very good reasons. But on the whole, they try and do a very good job, and journalism is a pillar, one of the important pillars of our democracy. So I always like to have a journalist in my books because I know how they work, I know how they think, and it helps me create character that way.
Right, and good journalism. I mean, good journalists have really broken some stories that needed to be told and changed the face of history on many occasions. So My hat's off to good journalism too. So let's take a look at the book, Midnight in Berlin. And let's begin with something you just mentioned. You have a fascination with World War II. Your last book, we talked about World War II as well, was based in World War II. What is it that draws you to that period in time?
Well, I suppose, one, I was born in the middle of the war in 1943. So, and two, my father, like many of the fathers or parents of your listeners, were involved in World War II. So there's a connection there. But the main reason is that World War II threw up extraordinary stories. There were extraordinary people doing great things in the name of a conflict which we, the West, had to win, and we did. But it was not always obvious that we were going to do that, certainly not in the early years of the war. So in that war lies great drama and great characters, and that must attract a novelist.
Right. And you're known for blending factual historical research with fiction. The same with characters. You touch on real characters and you bring them to your fiction story. You dedicate the book to the memory of Colonel Noel Mason McFarlane. Tell our listeners who he is and why you dedicated the book to him.
Well, the colonel was the British military attaché who arrived in Berlin in 1938. And he, or the character I created based on him, really is the hero of this book, because he saw very quickly that the policy of appeasement pursued by Western governments was not only just a failure, but would actually act as an incentive for conflict. He realized that Hitler was playing games with the West and really treating France and Britain with contempt. And so, after a year in post, a year in which he was at odds with his own ambassador and, of course, the policy of the British government, he put two plans to the British government to prevent a war that he saw as inevitable. And that's really the kind of the political drama of the story.
Right. And this, you came about this idea, though the idea was sparked while you were watching a documentary film. How did you put those bits together and think, hey, this is going to be my next book?
Well, I was attracted by the idea that here was a man who tried, through a very controversial policy then and indeed now, to get the British government to agree to a plan to assassinate Hitler in April 1939, on Hitler's 50th birthday, April the 20th. And the plan was very carefully worked out, and he followed the plan through by explaining what he believed would happen after such an assassination, namely that there'd be a military coup. And he did that knowing that the British government was pretty much going to say no. And indeed, the government, which was set on a course of appeasement, did indeed say no. But I was attracted by how brave he was. He was a whistleblower. He stood up and blew the whistle on the whole appeasement policy and tried in a desperate sort of throw of the dice to avert the war that he knew was inevitable.
Mm. And so Neville Chamberlain, who was the prime minister at that time, basically said, we are not going to do that. It's not sportsmanlike. He or his people said that, right?
His government certainly said that. And the actual quote from Lord Halifax, and this is on the record, the foreign secretary at the time, said, we have not yet reached the stage in our diplomacy with Germany when we need to substitute assassination for diplomacy. So, and that's a real quote in response to the assassination plan.
Right. So how difficult was it for you to go back and double-check all of this information?
Well, it took time and effort, but in the files of the Imperial War Museum in London, Colonel Noel Mason McFarlane's papers are all there, and in those papers he laid out how he came to London, how he put the plan to the government, and it wasn't entirely without reception, if you like, because the Secret Intelligence Service of Britain at the time did think this was a good idea. They too realized that only by getting rid of Hitler could one avert war. So, but you're quite right to say Mason McFarlane was sent back to Berlin, told this would not be sportsmanlike behavior, and he was dismissed in a few days afterwards.
Right. This is a kind of an aside, James, but when I was doing my research, my notes for the show today, I saw a photo of McFarlane, and he had a resemblance to Lord Mountbatten. Any connection there, as far as you know?
No connection at all. But you're quite right. He did. He had those sorts of hawk-like features. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll look a little bit more into the story of Midnight in Berlin. And I'm going to ask you, James, how you responded to the critic in your blog post. You know the bit I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Okay.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us. My guest is James McManus, and his book is Midnight in Berlin. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
All right, everybody in the car, let's go.
What are we going to do first when we get there, Mom? Go for a hike?
Sure.
What about canoeing? Can we go canoeing too?
I don't see why.
How long does it take to get to the forest?
It's not that far, sweetie.
Are we there yet?
Yep, we're here.
Already?
It's a short drive from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, bestselling author Kristen Harmel's hilarious novel, Meternity, a not-so-subtle but hilarious commentary on mommyhood, and returning guest Steve Barry with the 11th in his Malone thriller series, The 14th Colony. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM and 98.9 HD Channel 3. And catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
1150kknw.com, your connection to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest today is James McManus. His new book is called Midnight in Berlin. It's based on a true story. It's inspired by a true story, but it is a novel. James, I said before the break I was going to ask you about a scene in the book. And I'm laughing because you said during the break, I knew you were going to ask me that question. But there was a well-known journalist, Nigel Horn, former editor of the Daily Telegraph magazine, et cetera, who didn't like a particular scene that was very early on in the book. I believe it was chapter one, wasn't it? It was very early. Yeah. So tell us about that situation. And you responded to him via blog.
Fine. Well, first, if I can sort of set the scene and just say that this book is not just a political and diplomatic drama. It is also a love story set in Berlin on the eve of the war. And I wanted very much to put my characters to give some sort of background and depth to them and explain just how they were motivated. Now, the British military attaché's wife in this film is called Primrose. And I wanted to make it clear to the readers that she was a rebel. She was, if you like, certainly for the time, and this is set in 1939, sexually adventurous. And therefore, I described how when she first met the man she was due to marry, it was in a garden in Surrey in World War II, she surprised him, indeed shocked him, by basically opening herself up to him in a sort of sexual way that really wasn't what young ladies of breeding did that at that time. And that's what kicked off the controversy, because people said to me, particularly this man, Nigel Horn, no one, the idea that a young woman is going to indulge in oral sex with her fiancé at that particular time is just not what happened then. Well, my response is, A, how does anyone know? And B, I suspect that people have been indulging in such activities since they were in the cave. So it was a bit of a row, but to be honest, I have to say my own girlfriend didn't like that scene, but there you go.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've only got to go to Pompeii and look at some of the ruins out there to figure out, hey, this has been going on forever.
Exactly.
And they were very open about it. And I have to say to our listeners, this is a suggestive scene. It is not very explicit at all. It's not at all explicit. You do, however, get quite explicit about some of the torture. Why did you feel it was so important to put that in the book?
Well, I hope I wasn't too explicit about torture, but I did want to make it clear that the Gestapo was for the first thing, an extremely important part of the Nazi regime. It was the engine of that regime, if you like. And without the Gestapo, I don't think Hitler could have retained power. It was a highly efficient, highly brutal. And it did employ methods which both terrified those caught up in the web of the Gestapo and rippled through the wider German public. So they tortured people in order to create terror. For instance, the Gestapo would not pick people up at night. They did so in broad daylight so that everybody around the people they were arresting could see and thus be terrified. And that's the reason I went into some detail to describe what the Gestapo actually did. It also, I think, made it clear or gave some sort of context to the brothel that the Gestapo ran in Berlin, and this is perfectly true, in a discreet Berlin suburb, which was set up to look like a smart upscale restaurant, and which they used, it was wired for film and sound, which they used to trap and incriminate those they wished to destroy. So the Gestapo does have a role in this book, and quite an important one.
Right, and the leading character in that, she actually was German-Jewish.
Exactly.
And you say that even though, you know, the Nazis were against the Jews and going after the Jews, they would have, you know, it's not past them to put a German Jew into a situation like that, into the salon or the brothel, to entrap people even more, really.
Exactly. The Gestapo was run by a satanic character called Reinhard Heydrich. And he took a personal interest in this brothel. Indeed, he set it up. And now that's fact. In fiction, I have made the lead lady in the brothel, this Jewish woman, Sarah Sternstein, because it is entirely in keeping with Gestapo's practices to do such a thing in order to increase the blackmail hold over those that they can caught entangled with this particular woman. And why did she submit to the Gestapo? Because, of course, they had her brother in a concentration camp, and thus she too was being blackmailed. And that just fits the Gestapo method of operation, which shows just what a sort of brutal bunch they were.
Right, right. So what was the biggest challenge for you as a writer when you're telling the story, when you're trying to pull all these pieces together, when you're trying to blend fact with real characters, with fictional characters?
Well, I think for any writer of a novel, the real challenge is to make credible a love affair between two people. And here I had the British military attaché, who was indeed in real life taken to that particular brothel. And there I had this Jewish girl, 23-year-old girl, in the brothel. And I had somehow got to create a relationship between them. And I hope readers who get round to this book will think I've succeeded. Certainly in terms of the reviews so far in England and the UK, that's where I've been complimented most.
Mm-hmm. You're so articulate as a writer and as a speaker verbally. I'm wondering if you've ever written yourself into a deep hole, James.
Vicky, every writer has. Every writer has stepped back from a desk and torn up what he's written or deleted what he's written on his screen. It's always been the case. You have to go back and start again. And if I might just tell your listeners, the young Ernest Hemingway in Paris in 1922 sent his first short stories to Gertrude Stein, the famous author there. She read them all and sent them back with this brief advice: begin over again and concentrate. That's what you have to do.
I love that. I love begin over again. You know, I was listening to somebody who, I guess he runs a publishing company or something. I'm not sure. One of those self-publishing companies. But he said, people's first draft is always correct. And I'm driving down the freeway and think, is always the best. And I'm driving down the freeway thinking, heck no.
Exactly. You're right.
I mean, good writing is rewriting and rewriting and rewriting.
That's exactly why Hemingway is regarded as one of the great prose stylists of the last century.
Yeah, yeah. As who do you like to read yourself, James?
Well, right now I'm reading James Salters, a lot of. He's still with us, I think, a brilliant American author who has written a number of novels and short stories, and I think he's one of the greatest stylists writing today.
Why do you say that? What is it about his writing? I'm not familiar with his work, actually.
It's so hard to describe when prose simply grips you and someone is using words in a way that's rather like music. It's something you just simply fall for. But do read his books. His greatest novel, 1967, A Sport and a Pastime, is also an erotic masterpiece, I think, and is regarded as such.
Right, right. One of the key components of a good story is that the characters should grow and, you know, achieve this arc as they're going through the story. How do you make sure that happens with your characters? Because you really do develop strong characters.
I think you have to know the characters very well. And once you as a writer have really got to know the people you're writing about, they grow almost organically as you write, so to speak. That sounds a little bit fey, but it's true. And they grow and twist and turn throughout the story. What you do have, of course, is strong narrative. I'm a great believer in the novel moving readers from page to page with good narrative. And if you do that, your characters move and change with you, I find.
Right. And since you're basing your character on your protagonist, on a real person, a person who actually lived and were kind of relaying his story, how do you decide what to take from the real character and what to leave behind?
Well, that's an extremely good point. And it's an often asked question, and it's a very hard question to answer. Historical fiction, as in my case, I mean, it uses real people, but then takes considerable license with how they act and what they say and do. And I think the rule I operate is that I'm not going to be deliberately true to facts as they happen, but I'm going to be true to the character, to the times in which they operate, and the scenes and the setting. I'm not sure if that actually answered your question, but it's a very good one. And I don't... go on.
No, it's okay. Because I think a lot of this, probably listening to you, is once you've got your facts and your fictions, the rest becomes kind of organic, and you pull out, pull it out organically. Yeah. As managing director of the Times Supplement, how do you find time to write? This is always the big thing when people can't afford to stay at home and write all day long. How do they find the time to write? What's your schedule like?
The mornings are key to me, and I'm afraid it's just getting up early, up at 6, cup of tea, quick 10 minutes of yoga. Yes, I'm afraid I have to do that.
That's good.
And then 2 or 3 hours, and then I revise when I get back to the office in the evening. I mean, it's a pretty rigorous routine, and not a particularly social one for those with whom you share your life, but it's the only way I can write.
Right. So what do you hope listeners will take away from this novel?
It's not a message novel, but if they take away anything, I hope it is the fact that the British government, the French government, large swathes of American opinion all fell for a policy of appeasement, which was almost like a sort of religion. It carried the kind of the conviction of a religion, and only one or two whistleblowers, and President Roosevelt was very good on this too, stood up and said, actually, this is not the way to deal with Hitler. This is not the thing we should be doing. We should be standing up to him and backing him down. And if you look around the world today, you might well find a lesson to be learned from that.
Yes, I think you're right. And a lot of writers won't answer this, but do you have a favorite character in Midnight in Berlin?
Absolutely. Sarah Sternsheim is my favorite character. The name is that of a young woman who was at university with me, who is sadly no longer with us. But she and her family, obviously Jewish, came out of Germany in 1934, I think, and escaped. And she came to England, and I met her at university. So really, that novel is dedicated to her as well as to to the military attaché.
Well, James McManus, always a pleasure talking with you. Another great book, exquisitely written, impeccably researched. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, it's they may have concluded this is rather much a sort of a heavy wartime or pre-war story. It's not. I hope it's a story about credible people placed in an impossible situation and trying to find love and survival.
Awesome. Thank you for being with us today. Appreciate it, James.
Thank you very much indeed.
And you can find out more about James and his other books and his work in general at jamesmcmanus.com, jamesmcmanus.com. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work. This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage on Vashon Island, we cover the world of animals. This week, April 24th, it's an encore presentation of Animal World. Tune in to hear Best, bioenergetic synchronization technique practitioner, Dr. Nels Rasmussen, do remote rebalancing and healing sessions for our listeners and their animal friends. Dr. Nels is amazing, and you'll enjoy hearing him work on Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, best-selling author Kristen Harmel's hilarious novel, Meternity, a not-so-subtle but hilarious commentary on mommyhood, and returning guest Steve Barry with the 11th in his Malone thriller series, The 14th Colony. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM and 98.9 HD Channel 3. And catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Radio for your body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, my next guest is Josh Leves. He's an investigative journalist and expert on modern fatherhood and parent of three. His new book, All In, How Our Work-First Culture Fails Dads, Families, and Businesses, and How We Can Fix It Together. He spent years reporting for CNN on air and online and serving as the network's dad columnist. Prior to CNN, he was a reporter for NPR and has won many prizes, including 6 Peabody Awards, 2 Edward R. Moreau Awards, and a designation as a Journalist of the Year from the Atlanta Press Club. His new book is called All In. Josh Leves, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Well, pretty impressive background there, Josh. You've been working at this a long time and done some great work. And I know this work was inspired by a real-life situation for you, which kind of took legs. But let's before we dive into the book, let's just talk about what was happening in your personal life. You're expecting the birth of a child, and what? Tell us what happened.
Right. Yeah, and this is what's so tricky, because this personal situation that I'll tell you about came about after I was already covering fatherhood on the air. So I had this background knowledge, you know?
Right.
And then all of a sudden, the tables were turned, and I was the dad in the news. What happened there that you're referring to is we already had two sons, and my wife was pregnant with our third child, and we realized that for a combination of reasons, I would be needed at home after our third child, our daughter, was born. And that is not strange. It's not even that unusual anymore. Dads do caregiving. Unfortunately, the laws and policies and stigmas in the U.S. and around the world have really not kept up with reality. So I was under this very strange policy at CNN, under which anyone could get 10 paid weeks to be caregiver to a new child, except a guy who had his baby born to his own wife.
And that makes, so, how much sense does that make?
Well, unfortunately, that's not the only company that had a policy like that. And so in the book, I dig into how this happened. But, yeah, like if I gave my daughter up for adoption and another guy I worked with adopted her, he would get the 10 paid weeks. Or if I had a same-sex domestic partner and he adopted a baby and I did not adopt his baby, I could still get 10 paid weeks to care for his baby. But I couldn't get it to care for my own real-life baby.
Yeah.
So I went to the company totally in secret, and I was like, let's you know, fix this. But they wouldn't give me an answer. And then months went by with no answer. Then my daughter was born prematurely in an emergency, and then the rest is the legal case of what happened next.
Yeah, so she was a 4-pound preemie, and so you stayed at home with her at that point?
Yes. Well, so what happened was when she was being born, you know, prematurely, and my wife was quite sick, I was still messaging work, and they wouldn't give me an answer. And then, 11 days later, I was home holding my 4-pound preemie and caring for my sick wife and my two boys and telling work, I have to have an answer. Am I getting this or not? And that's when they said no. And then, the short version is that I pushed again, still no luck, and then I took legal action and contested this policy, claiming it was our position that it was a form of gender discrimination, and the company disagreed. But we launched a legal battle over this policy, and I came to understand that it was reflective to so many people. My case was reflective of this broader problem in the country.
Right. Well, there are a lot of issues that are supporting the current status quo, if you will. We'll get into those in just a second, but let me just share some quick facts with our listeners. 1 in 5 dads with working wives are primary caregivers to their preschool-aged children. About half of all working dads would rather stay home if their spouse has made enough money to live on. 3/4 want more time with their kids, and virtually all say that when considering a new job, they look into how much time it would interfere with family time. 6 in 10 Americans say the most important role of a father is to teach morals and values. Only 4 in 10 believe making money is the primary function. And the vast majority of top executives, male and female, see work-family conflicts as primarily a woman's problem. So we're dealing with, as you put somewhere, madmen mentality.
That's right.
We just have not moved with the times.
Yeah, and so this is why I started reporting all those facts, you know, like the ones that you just cited, and those are in the book. And what we need is a big reality check. You know, what I explained to people is that, look, no one had ever explained this that I had ever heard. No one had ever explained this to me, certainly, until I started digging in. I came to understand this, that all of our work structures, our laws and our policies and our stigmas, they were literally created in the Mad Men era. We were coming out of the war. It was this new America, new American economy, new concept of what it is to be a superpower, what it is to be successful in America, what it is to be a corporation in America. And they were built based on a strictly gendered idea that women and babies stay home and men stay at work, and that's how things are supposed to work. And so what we have now is this incredible disconnect between what families are really like and the way that workplaces are designed.
Right. So when you began writing this book, you say your agent steered you in the right direction by saying, Josh, this is your call to action. Describe in your own words your book to our listeners, if you will.
Sure. So it is a call to action. You know, you're right. My agent and my publisher at HarperCollins, HarperOne, they said the same thing. They said, we want you to lay out the steps. Because what happened in my case, listeners should know, is that after I took legal action, eventually Time Warner, the company, decided to revolutionize its policy. And they made it much, much better for virtually all parents, for moms and dads. Moms got more time after a birth as a result of the change that they made. So I know that we can bring about changes in this country. And I know that speaking out matters. So what I do in this book is I give you a reality check. I help everyone understand what's really going on with the American family. Dads are the most misunderstood part of the American family. These stereotypes reign, and because they do, people in power, like in corporations, the study that you just cited, and in government, still believe that dads actually don't do much at home, and that dads should be at work all the time. And so, of course, they're not going to want to give things like paternity leave or flexible hours to men, because in their view, men are just going to use that to kick up their feet and let their wives do everything anyway. So I give this reality check about what's really going on with the American family, the actual egalitarianism that we have achieved at home. Men and women are involved equally with our children and on behalf of our families. But I show how out of touch that is with the workplace. And then I look at the laws and the corporate policies that we can take advantage of that will build stronger businesses. This is proven. Stronger businesses, stronger national economy, and stronger families.
Right. So let's just look at what paid family leave is and is not, because that's obviously one of the primary issues here. What exactly is paid family leave?
Yeah, and you know, it's really good to talk to you about this. The state of Washington is in a really interesting situation with respect to paid family leave. So, look, paid family leave is not what people imagine. When people hear paid family leave, they originally think that this somehow means that laws are going to require businesses to pay people when they're not working. So that's not what paid family leave is in this country. Paid family leave is an insurance system. It exists now in California and New Jersey and Rhode Island. And what happens is there is a very small payroll deduction that comes out of people's paychecks. And it's so small. And then when they need paid family leave, not just to care for a child, but also to care for an elderly parent, which more people are doing, or to care for a sick spouse, or to care for yourself, yes, after an illness, you get paid out of that fund, and the business can stop paying you during that time. So the statistics are in. It is hugely successful. The number of businesses that say that profits are at least staying the same, if not going up, is in the 90s. So it is very, very successful. And now New York just passed paid family leave, supposed to kick in 2018. And Washington passed it several years ago, but still hasn't gotten it going yet. And so fingers crossed there.
Well, why doesn't that surprise me? Oh, my gosh. Okay. So I know it's working in California, New Jersey, Rhode Island. Some companies are doing well on these issues, mostly right. Silicon Valley, it seems. Facebook, Yahoo, Google, Bank of America. That kind of surprised me, because that's what you think of as a traditional kind of company.
Yeah. But actually, that's a sign. You know, more and more traditional companies are starting to wake up to this reality. You know, sometimes I hear from people inside companies saying that they're, you know, using my book and they're having conversations about various things. And so I get to find out sometimes in advance about the companies that are going to be making these announcements. And Coca-Cola was one of them. Talk about traditional company. You know, I'm based in Atlanta. Coca-Cola is one of the best known brands on earth. It's one of the original huge American companies, if not the original. And they just announced a brand new policy. So more and more traditional places are starting to do this. And I always tell people it's not just because they want to be nice. It's because it is proven to be good for business. So we need good public policies. But when corporations decide to enact legitimate, gender-neutral, paid family leave programs, they save money. And what I do in the book is I follow the money. I follow the dollars. So I show people why it's a saving.
Right, right. Well, we're going to, take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you a little bit more about, let's bust some of these myths around men and fatherhood, because, you know, you talk about the Neanderthals in the world. I don't know too many of them myself, so I don't know where that's coming from on TV. We see a lot on TV.
Right.
Josh's new book is called All In, How Our Work First Culture Fails Dads, Families, and Businesses, and How We Can Fix It Together. And that's a key thing here. We have to have this conversation together, male and female. And we'll talk more with Josh Leves in just a moment. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Conscious Living for Conscious People. Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. My guest in this segment is Josh Levs. His new book is All In, How Our Work-First Culture Fails Dads, Families, and Businesses, and How We Can Fix It Together. And Josh has been a journalist for a long time with CNN, NPR. This book, his agent described as his call to action. And Josh, you share some amazing stories in this book. I want to get to a couple of those in just a moment because some of them, as we say in England, left me gobsmacked. I was like, what? Are you kidding me? But, you know, it's like caveman days come back. But I wanted to begin with how the media represents men at large. It irritates the heck out of me. I'm starting to see a change, actually, because I write quite a few TV commercials. And so it irritates the heck out of me. I do watch commercials to see how they work and how they don't work. And Right. It's always the woman smiling doing the laundry. But I've noticed lately that there are some men getting involved in this. So there's a slight change there. But, you know, most of the sitcoms that we have present men as absolute idiots.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's incredible. And, you know, so it's interesting because now, you know, I travel a lot. I do speeches all over the place, companies, conferences, all over the place. And I actually start with this idea, and I show them these commercials. This is the beginning, and a lot of guys in the book think that this is really the source of the problem. So what we have are all these false images out there of dads as clueless, as incapable, completely out of touch with reality. And there was this great study that I said in the book that was conducted by Dove Men Plus Care, and they found that in lots of countries all over the world, that guys are saying that they do not recognize these images of masculinity that are in so much of pop culture. And that makes sense. Of course they don't, because these images are false and they're based on stereotypes. And, you know, Vicki, it used to be that when I would talk about this on the air or write columns about it on CNN.com, some people would call in or write me and say, come on, relax, it's just a joke. But what they didn't understand and what I get to explain in the book is that these images of dads as incapable of handling our children, as dumb, as buffoons, as bumbling, this is the fuel behind the backward policies. If you believe that guys don't do much at home, that guys are lazy, that guys are incapable, then of course you're not going to support paternity leave, because why would the guy need that time off? You really got to make sure the woman's the one at home. So of course less than 5% of our CEOs are women, because all the policies are still designed to push women to stay home, because there's still this popular belief that men aren't going to do anything at home. So counteracting that basic idea actually has real-life consequences that matter.
Right. You know, I'm not familiar with this, but I saw an article with an interview that where you'd been talking about this book, and Amazon Mom membership was brought up, whereas in other countries it's Amazon Parent membership. What's that about?
Right. So there were a lot of people that wanted to push Amazon to change from Amazon Mom to Amazon Parent. And that involved this whole idea that, you know, dads are parents too. And a lot of the things being sold through Amazon Mom were also of interest to dads. And there was a guy who organized this wonderful private Facebook group that I'm a part of that has all these dad bloggers who work together. And he he's in my book, but he unfortunately he died. And one of the things he wanted to see changed was that part of Amazon. And a lot of people took up the cause and spoke out. And we don't know if it was a result or not, but Amazon did make this change to Amazon Parent. And, you know, these things do matter. It is very important for everyone to get this reality check, you know, as I was just saying in the last block, when we are all forced to realize that men are parenting as much as women, that the average working dad on a work day spends 3 hours caring for his children, with his children, that virtually all dads who live with our children care for them in every major category, either every day of the week or several days a week. When we come to understand that men are just as much parents as women are, then we have to, as a natural result of that, update our laws and our policies and drop these stigmas that are hurting us. So every victory on that path counts. And, you know, getting Amazon to change to Amazon Parent, like it already had in some other countries, that was a great achievement by the guys who really launched and fought that battle.
Yeah, yeah. You talk in the book about, you know, fathers. We often hear that mothers are overextended and they've got all these balls in the air and juggling everything. But men are, too. I mean, I have a brother. I have a brother-in-law who both raised kids. They both took turns in staying home with their respective partners to raise the kids. They took it in turns to go to work or stay at home because when they had children, they decided they'd rather have less money and raise their kids themselves. And this happened. And now, of course, they're doing the grandparent thing and they're wonderful, wonderful parents. But I've heard my brother say over the years occasionally, you know, sometimes I feel invisible because, you know, he's at work and then he comes home and he's juggling this. He said, except when it comes to handing out the money. But what are some of the really common battles that men are dealing with? Because you write very honestly with this. You're talking with a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. Guys are struggling, too. You know, men are having as much work-life conflict, if not more, than women. That's what these studies have found. And work-life conflict sounds like kind of this nebulous thing. But what it really means is that guys, just like women, are losing out on a lot of sleep, losing out on things both at work and at home because of these structures, you know, and so it's important to understand what's happening. For example, there's this thing called the hours stigma, which is proven, in which men in the workplace, this is incredible, they are raised up the ranks literally for sitting at their desks for more hours, not for getting more work done. Mm-hmm. And that's because there are still some old-time, old-fashioned thinking bosses who see a guy sitting at his desk more and they say, aha, there's a guy who's putting work ahead of his family. That's the kind of guy I want. But businesses that see through that, they start to realize that they're actually not helping themselves. They should be judging their employees based on how much they get done. And when they do that instead, they find that the dad who needed to leave early to handle a Little League game or needed a flexible schedule is actually one of their most productive employees. So because there's still that backward thinking, a lot of guys do get stuck in more and more hours at work, and then they still want to be active at home, so they're rushing home. And in the book, I created this thing called the stretch out scale. And I said, okay, how stretched out do you feel on a scale of 1 to 10? You know, not taking care of yourself, always being exhausted. Almost all the guys said 10. You know, one guy told me 8. It's really, men are struggling, but they've been struggling in the shadows because men have felt that they cannot talk about this publicly. And that gets back to these stigmas about masculinity. And so it's really important to get past these as well, because it also goes another step. It goes to mental health. It goes to physical health. It's impacting our lives. And so I look at the research here, and I interview lots of dads about what their struggles are and, you know, how they're trying to find ways to cope. And some are having a drink every night more than they want to. Some are getting addicted to video games here and there just to give their minds a break. It's tough. It is a tough, tough time. And so what we need to do is create structures in which work and life can coexist. That makes better employees and it makes families stronger.
Yes, you have a section of the book called Mind, Body, Spirit, and you write very openly about how one night in the middle of the night you stood by your wife's side of the bed. She was fast asleep. I reached down and tapped her arm a few times to wake her up. And the question you asked her was, I'm doing well, right? I've made good decisions, right? It's all okay, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah, I was trying, so I write about that, my experience with anxiety. I didn't know what it was. No one had ever talked to me about anxiety. And so when I called the doctor, fortunately, I knew enough to call the doctor the next day. And he said, oh, this is so interesting. You've made it to this period of your life, and you've never experienced anxiety before. But guys are experiencing this. And, you know, it's tough. It makes things really tough. You know, 3,000-foot perspective. Think about this. The most natural things for human beings to do are to love, right, create relationships, mm-hmm. and also to work, to forage for food and build homes and do these kinds of things. So the idea that work and life have to be in so much conflict that we are getting stressed and anxious and exhausted, that's actually unnatural. And it comes from the fact that we have sexist systems. That's why so much work-life conflict exists. Our workplaces were created for work-life balance in one way. The man works all the time. The woman stays home all the time. There's your work-life balance. The idea that one person would have a life at home and at work is the opposite of how our work was created. And so if we're going to tackle these mental health structures, we have to be willing to look at healthier ways of operating in the workplace.
Yeah, well, you have some really good stories in the book. Which really illustrates the way that some people think. And I find it really shocking, but I know it's right. I know they're out there. There's one in particular that, as I said, left me with my mouth wide open. It was the story of the state trooper. Share that with our listeners, with you, because the response when the trooper asked for time off was, women are supposed to do the caregiving unless they're in a coma or dead.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, that was typical. Unfortunately, here are all these men who, and this is proven about the stigmas, that men are demoted, fired, lose work opportunities for being caregivers. Because what we have is this backward cycle. The overwhelming majority of today's dads are very, very involved in their families and put family first. And, you know, you were reading those statistics in my book. They value time with families over work. Unfortunately, the tiny number who don't are the CEOs, because there's this vicious cycle in which CEOs raise those few guys up the ranks. So in that case, what we have was a state trooper who was refused the time that he's legally entitled to. And the reason that he was given, his boss said, that women are supposed to be the ones to care for the baby unless they're in a coma or dead. And I have another guy in my book who had to leave work during the day because his wife, she was 38 weeks pregnant. There was an emergency. The placenta stopped working. They had to do an urgent delivery. Everything worked out well, and all he did was miss a couple days the rest of the week. But when he came back into work on Monday, his boss called him in and rebuked him. How dare you take off so much time? Don't you know we need you around here? And that boss was a pregnant woman.
Oh, my gosh.
There are also women who, how's that for gobsmacked, right?
Yeah, really.
There are also women who unfortunately, in becoming managers, have kind of adopted this old mentality about men as well.
Yeah. So, big question, and I know your book is part of it, and I know the work you do as a columnist is another part of it, and the speaking that you do is another part of it. But we can't have this conversation without involving both sexes, just like equality for women. If we want equality for men as far as family leave, we both, male and female, have to engage on this conversation. How do we begin that at home? How do we begin it in our daily lives?
Ah, great question. Okay. So the way to begin it at home is something that I touch on in the book, and there's a chapter about this. We need to watch out for these things called male privilege and female gatekeeping. So You know, what that means is taking a good hard look at how we behave. Are we doing what we can to live out the equality that we profess to believe in? So male privilege is this mentality that we can fall into as guys because of how we were raised, in which when we see the baby needs to be changed and we think, you know, okay, honey, that's really more your thing. It doesn't happen all that much necessarily, but it happens. And female gatekeeping is just as bad. Female gatekeeping is when women say, no, honey, you're going to break the baby. That's not how you change the baby. That's not how you dress the baby. And you got to remember, this is how we're raised. We are raised. Girls are taught that you, as a girl, are somehow naturally better at caregiving for an infant. And so we need to get past that in our own lives. And we need to work together to build better laws and policies. And so what I do in the book, as you know, is I lay out the steps. HarperCollins, the Harper one, they said to me, literally, give us steps 1 through 10. So I lay out steps, how to work in a very positive way with your business to build great policies, how to reach out to the government to build better structures, and how to drop these stigmas. You know, think of the stigmas as a bully, and let's all stand up against them. And the book is called All In because we are all in this together, men and women. And when we talk about it in this broad way, in which men and women feel welcome in the conversation, we make real progress.
Well, Josh Leves, thank you so much. We are right at the end of our show. An important book, All In, How Our Work-First Culture Fails Dads, Families, and Businesses, and How We Can Fix It Together. You can find out much more about Josh and his work at joshleves.com. You can also call me at 800-495-7617. Email me at info@conversationslive.net if you have questions, comments, or missed anything. And we have to run. We're past our limit here. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.